Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. This is Bonnie Kay, and welcome to the Straight Wives Talk Show. This is a hard-hitting show that discusses the complexity of marriages between straight women to gay men. Each week, my guests and I discuss issues that affect over 4 million women in this country and millions more around the world who find themselves unknowingly married to a gay or bisexual man. If you have any comments you would like to make or questions during this segment, please feel free to email me at bonkay@aol.com. That's bonkaye@aol.com. Before I introduce my guests for this evening, I just want to mention that we're starting now to work on our next healing weekend, which will be next April in beautiful Irvine, California. It's going to be the best healing weekend yet. We have some of the best speakers that you could ever imagine and workshops that will be going on. We'll be staying in a beautiful hotel at a very reasonable rate. And it's a wonderful opportunity to put your life back on track, to meet so many of the women who can understand you without having to say a word, who have the empathy and compassion because they're living that life also. If you're interested in joining the weekend, or if you'd like to be on my newsletter list, just write to me at bonkaye@aol.com, or you can go to my website at gayhusbands.com, and there's a link there for the healing weekend, and also to get the newsletter. Without further ado, I'm going to first introduce my co-hostess, my gal pal, Deborah Sutton. Hi, Deb.
Hi, Bonnie. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for helping me out tonight. As always, whenever I want to co-host, you're always there to help me, so I appreciate it very much.
It's very good.
And how are things in hot Texas?
Oh, they're good.
Are they hot?
They're hot.
Is it very hot down there at this time of the year?
Yes, it is.
Are you waiting for August till it really hits?
I'm waiting till after August.
No, it's still going to be very hot, trust me. I've been there after August, too. It's horrible. but that's summertime in Texas, right?
Yes.
So we're going to introduce our guest, who's one of our most requested return guests. I get more email when you're on the show. Ira Gelman, Dr. Ira Gelman's joining us tonight. And thank you so much,
everybody.
Ira, for coming back and joining us.
My pleasure.
I know that the last time you were here, we had so many nice compliments about the show and the things that you say and your perspective. And tonight, I wanted to talk about a few different issues to get your insight, because you are a psychologist, you know, therapist, doctorate. You have your doctorate in sexual behavior. Is that correct? Am I saying that right?
Yeah, usually human sexuality, but yeah.
Human sexuality, right. So you're very up and tuned to all kinds of situations, and that's why you bring such great insight to this. But I want to talk a little bit tonight about something I've been writing about a little bit. I saw a program on television a couple of weeks ago. It was on, like, a Good Morning Show from ABC or CBS, where they were talking about the women who were part of the Me Too movement. These are women who were sexually violated by people like Harvey Weinstein and numerous other people who were accused, and the gymnasts who were violated by, you know, their doctor. And there were several psychologists on the show, and what they were saying was that they were trying to follow up, like, a year later, how it affected people. And many of the women stated that being able to tell their story and having people believe them validated them. It didn't change the situation of what happened, but they started to feel as if, you know, they were starting to heal because they were able to tell it and people believed them. And I think that, you know, maybe you can explain a little bit that when you are a victim of something, you know, so hideous or insidious, that when you are able to tell your story, do you think that makes a difference?
It makes a tremendous difference, because a lot of people don't understand that when one of the basic premises in counseling is the ability to get out of the isolation that a person feels that they're in. So if people don't believe you, it keeps a person in this cocoon, and the cocoon in this case is suffocating. So by having
people... And I think
people,
that one of the things... Yeah, I'm sorry.
Go ahead,
I just had another
thought.
Okay. No, thinking about how much this whole thing has changed. For instance, 40 years ago, when I was much younger, and you were really much younger, but if a woman accused a man of rape, all of a sudden people would be accusing her of seducing him, asking for it, even though it's not true. But I'm saying that's why so many women never talked about it, because they were made to feel as if they were victimized. They were the victim, not victimized, but that, you know, that they were not victims because this is what they wanted. They were going into bars. Well, you should know better than to go into a bar. They were wearing seductive clothes. You should know better than that. Where they could be doing absolutely nothing.
I said, so it was their fault.
Right, so it was their fault, exactly. And so that's why I think for so many years, women would say, well, did you report it? No, because they would have to go through some terrible kind of procedure, you know, in a hospital with a rape kit, with people who aren't very sympathetic to them, making them feel as if they've done something dirty or bad themselves. So I think I've seen that change, Deborah, haven't you, over the years?
Yes, it has changed.
That where women are not afraid to speak out about, you know, physical abuse so much anymore, and sexual abuse. And
it's getting better.
I was saying,
it's getting.
That
I mean,
is
a lot
getting
of
better.
Talking about it, at least talking about it. You know, talking about abuse and things that.
And
we'll
I think, like Ira was saying, that when you don't talk about it and you bottle it up. And then it only creates, do you think psychologically it creates more shame in a person?
Yeah, you know, it's not like it's a one-size-fits-all. For some people, dealing with an issue and letting time distance themselves between the event and the present is what they need. But for a lot of other people, talking about something is a necessity. But I wouldn't say that it's that way for 100% of the population, because talking about something can, you know, have a person relive the horror. And, you know, how many times can you relive something? So for some people, moving on, if that's their choice, is a positive thing to do. But for other people, having somebody that you can talk to about something is vitally important to do, because it takes, as you said, that there's the shame. And when it comes to sexuality in our culture, there still is, you know, a double standard, you know, the old expression, the stud versus slut syndrome. If a young guy today, I'm talking 18, 19, has a kid, that actually, when he's with that little kid in the mall, that's going to be an attraction for a lot of young ladies. They're going to look at the guy and go, ooh, ah, that's so cute, look at him. If you take a young woman of the same age with a kid, you are not going to have anywhere near that same level of support. There's going to be a lot of stigma against her. If it was a young father that, let's say, had a child care issue and one day needed to bring his kid to work, he would not get anywhere near the flack in most cases as if a young woman did it, because she would be told, this is your professional life, you need to separate it. So even under the best of circumstances, there still is a very big divide about how males and females experience sexuality. Guys associate sexuality with something that is more of pleasure. You rarely have girls have conversations with their own family about, or especially like in schools, about pleasure. It's always about, don't either get some kind of venereal disease or don't get raped. You don't ever hear sex being spoken about in a positive light, and that still exists today. So the Me Too movement, I don't know if you've been following it, but there actually came out maybe a month ago, a group of wrestlers, I believe it was Ohio State, they came out saying how the doctor for the wrestling team would abuse them. It was a male doctor, and he would use his position. He would hang out in the locker room when he didn't have any business to be there watching them shower. And there's a congressman today, Jim Jordan, who is a two-time NCAA champion that was an assistant coach there for a while. And then they were saying that he was looking the other way. And now he's saying that he had no idea that was going on. But it's just interesting that this Me Too issue or phenomenon, the movement, it does apply to guys. And I don't know if you remember the great Sugar Ray Leonard. He was a welterweight and middleweight boxing champion. And he had said in his autobiography, I want to say within the last 5-10 years, that he was sexually abused by, I think it was a coach. So you're starting to also have men come forward to talk about.
And do you think that's harder for men to come forward than it is for women?
Yeah. And the reason for that is, when a woman comes forward, her femininity is not being challenged. When a man was abused, even though it happened when he was much younger, he feels now that his masculinity is being shredded, because I'm a guy, I never should have let this happen to me. So it's different, and a lot of people don't understand that masculinity for a male is incredibly important. If you take a group of 5-year-old boys of all different races, religions, and put them in a room together, they're not going to get in a fist fight over names of race or religion or ethnicity. But if you ask the question, who here is the sissy or girly boy, they're all going to pick the kid who they think is the most vulnerable and point fingers at him, and either he's going to just cry or he'll fight back, he'll physically fight. So if you can think about that, masculinity is the very first thing for a male that he is very much aware of and feels the need to defend it.
I could see
that. Will lead me back to another. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, I could see how that would be very hard for for a man to talk about being sexually molested.
Yeah, and
it's Ira,
not like
you're on that
for a,
Deborah.
You know, femininity
Deborah,
for a woman.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say that it's not as if femininity is not equally as important for a female, but the difference is that a woman does not feel like if she gets in a confrontation with someone and she walks away, you know, that's perfectly acceptable. If a guy gets into a verbal confrontation and then walks away, unless he really is confident in his ability to defend himself, he is going to feel very cowardly. And that's something that a lot of parents don't get today, is when they say, oh, just walk away. Well, first off, you don't ever turn your back on somebody who is a potential foe that may hit you when you turn your back on them. Secondly, if he does not have the ability to defend himself, he is not walking away as the bigger man. He's walking away feeling like he was just demasculinized,
and then
where a
shame
woman would not have that same feeling.
And then shame would come with that?
Oh, totally, without question. Without question.
One of the things that Deborah and I have discussed on another show, and we just want like to hear your opinion on this. There are men who claim that they were sexually violated by women and how traumatizing it is, and they, you know, it's hard for us to really understand that.
Yeah, you know, I, unfortunately, you know, when people are talking and they say things, you never know how much of it is true versus, you know, I'm just trying to get sympathy or attention, you know, at the moment. You know, it's like there are certain people that are against male circumcision, and they're claiming that, you know, it has violated a male's ability to decide what he wants to his body. And then, you know, these people, they'll find one guy who's willing to come out there and state how he feels violated. I've never, ever heard a male that was circumcised in my whole life ever say that. But somewhere out there, some guy is willing to. So, you know, when a guy says that he was violated, you know, by a woman, the big difference is that typically the guy is not going to feel the fear of physically being assaulted. And that's the line where, you know, I'm going to draw there, where when a female is assaulted by a guy, the guy is probably a lot heavier, a lot stronger, and there's that pure physical fear of being dominated, where with a guy, it's a different issue. It is a very different issue.
Yeah, because they have a whole movement for that, for men who were sexual victims of women. And, you know, this one particular gentleman who is very involved in it writes about his experience when he was in the service. And some woman, do you remember the story, Deb, how that went?
I think it was the wife of a friend who was pregnant. The woman was pregnant.
Right, she was pregnant.
And I guess he woke up with her, you know, wanting sex with him. And
she gave him no choice.
Well, I'd like to know how they woke up next to each other and how he had no choice. I don't understand how he just could not have said,
well,
you know.
He claimed that if she said to him that if you don't have sex with me, I'm going to accuse you of rape.
Like she blackmailed him into it.
And so in his mind, by having sex with her, that eliminated the possibility that she was going to blackmail him in the future, right?
Yes.
Exactly, because he was in the service, and they said that, you know, this would be a blemish. He could be disbarred, you know, if he would do that.
Well, this is a very unique case. So I hope he's doing well today. I don't want us to start getting a lot of hate mail here, so I'm trying to answer this, you know, delicately.
Yeah, it was hard for us to understand it because we still feel like you say men have the strength, they have the power, they don't have to sit in. But there's a whole movement on this, and I look at all these men, they have like group meetings of men who were sexually raped by women. So
yeah,
I was just wondering your input. But
Yeah, I don't think that's as common as, you know, it's like when people are trying to bring balance to something. In this case, you know, something like 9 out of 10 people that are assaulted sexually are female. So, you know, when these groups are trying, I mean, it happens to men also, and it could happen from a female. I'm not saying it doesn't, but the level of severity and the frequency that does not compare.
Yeah, I didn't take it like it does. But now we're on the subject of that. Let me ask you this question. A number of gay husbands claim that the reason that they're gay is because when they were young, they were assaulted sexually. And I never quite understand that reasoning. You know, they claim that because they were raped or they, you know, whatever the story was. That's the reason that, you know, these feelings lingered all these years and the feelings of guilt, and they don't want to be gay and they wouldn't have been, but because they were a victim. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, Bonnie, if you had interviewed a lot of gay men, they would be outraged at other men who use that as an excuse, because they would say that you're really dirtying our community, that you are using a traumatic event as the excuse of being gay instead of celebrating it, not to mention giving fuel to the people who want to change homosexuality. So in the gay community, that line of reasoning would be looked on as an outrage. What typically happens is the guys who are married to women who are gay, they are self-hating in most cases. That's why they married women. So they're looking for some type of an excuse that they can feel good about or better about themselves. So in many of those cases, you know, going back to what I said about lying, you never know when someone's telling the truth. And in many of the cases, most people that were sexually abused do not have issues over their sexual orientation. So as far as men who say that, most of the time they're either lying, or they're just deeply disturbed and they have a lot of other issues and they're just using that as an excuse to justify their marriage to a woman. Not to mention to their parents, that they come from a family that doesn't accept someone being gay. So this is a way of gaining that acceptance and continuing to perpetuate a lie.
I just feel that it doesn't make sense to me. Yeah, I think it doesn't really make sense to me because I don't think that anyone's sexuality is determined by, well, I shouldn't say that. I think for some women, they may choose, you know, to be with another woman because they've been really bludgeoned by men. You know, let's say they're in for a long time period of being sexually abused, you know, from the time they're little girls, that maybe they're just afraid of men. So I don't know about how it works, you know, that way. But I don't understand why that somebody would want to be gay if they were sexually abused. I don't think that's a reason to it. I don't get the whole concept, to be honest with you.
Well, if they were being honest, then what probably happened was the experience was enjoyable for them, and that's what stayed with them. And instead of acknowledging that experience of physical pleasure, because that is an issue in dealing with kids who have been abused. Many times the person who did the abuse is someone who the child trusted. So there actually could have been pleasure that was experienced on behalf of the child that now they're not going to verbalize that, and that's going to add to the shame, because the thinking would be, if something happened to me that is so bad, but I enjoyed it, what does that say about me? And that is a piece of counseling that is very important, you know, that has to take place, especially in dealing with kids or dealing with adults that are now going for help from the trauma that they faced when they were much younger.
One of the things that Deborah wrote about just recently today, yesterday, was about the psychological effects of what are the effects of being hurt by a narcissist. Deb, can you talk a little bit about that? And we'll get Iris
input. What was it, the psychological effects of what?
Being hurt by a narcissist.
Oh, yes, I wrote about that today. Do you have it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I
do. Do you want to read it? Or?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm going to read this and then get your opinion on it, okay?
Yeah.
It says, at first, there's shock and disbelief. There's also confusion. The truth is confusion has been there throughout the relationship with the narcissist. Living with one is like being entombed. It's slow-moving death. Everything about you is being erased. You are there for one purpose only, and this is to serve the narcissist. When the relationship ends, you don't know who you are anymore. You will go over the entire relationship until you figure it out. Something was off, and you knew it. You just didn't know what it was. After a few years of going over the entire relationship, you begin to understand what happened to you. You feel angry someone could use you, abuse you, and then dispose of you like you never existed. You also become angry at yourself for staying in an abusive relationship. Then you ask yourself, what is wrong with me? Why did I stay in this? You realize you must examine your life as a whole and look back into your past, all the way back to your childhood, to understand yourself and why you would stay with an abuser. Then you realize you sacrificed your own self in this relationship. You say to yourself, no more, never again. You know you need to make changes in your life moving forward, so you begin to form boundaries. Forming boundaries is not easy as people think. If you are a people pleaser and a fixer, people are shocked and angry when you begin to take care of yourself. People are used to you saying yes to everything. They are upset when you say no. You must stick with your boundaries and caring for yourself no matter how upset others get. When you realize your toxic relationship with the narcissist needed to end, you're grateful that it's over, but you still suffer through a lot of pain. It's a battle of the mind between the illusion the narcissist created and the truth. Surely it would not have all been a lie. How could he fake those feelings from me for decades? So many questions you struggle to make sense of. While going through the pain of all the unanswered questions, you must keep living, must keep moving forward because life doesn't stop. You have duties and responsibilities. Coping can be very difficult, especially when one is suffering from the after effects of a long and abusive relationship. You'll have anxiety and fear. You may isolate yourself and build up walls to keep people out. You may join support groups where you hear other stories like yours. This can be validating as people in your life who have not experienced may not understand. You may hear statements like, why don't you just move on, get over it, and move on with your life. You begin to notice people in your life who used to invalidate you. You start removing toxic people from your life. You work on yourself and your healing, recovering from narcissistic abuse and from old childhood wounds. You look for ways to protect yourself in the future and moving forward. You read about narcissism, narcissistic personality disorder, cluster B disorders, and manipulators. You come to a full understanding of what happened, of why you put up with this. You become aware. You are aware of yourself, your own actions, and the actions of toxic people. You come in acceptance. You realize that your life is now peaceful without the chaos the narcissist brought into your life. You are grateful the relationship ended and for your freedom. You appreciate your life, your loved ones, and the meaning of small everyday things in life. You begin to live again and feel alive again. Many years have passed without contact with the narcissist. You're doing well. He sees you and can see you have recovered. He tells you he's sorry for his past behavior and has reasons for why his behavior was so bizarre and abusive at this guard. What could you do? Could you see through him? And that was it.
I said,
so,
what would you do? Would you see through him? Because some women go back.
What would you do? All right, can you see him? And they do go back, Ira, right?
Yeah. I mean, you're describing, it's not even a narcissist. It's more like it's a sociopath now at that point. Remember, they're very similar to each other, but
yeah.
You know, the narcissist, at least, when you bring it to their attention, how they need to, like, think of others, they'll be, oh, okay. Where the sociopath, they're the ones that are the real manipulators and the ones that you always think are gonna eventually change.
Once somebody said that to me online, someone I don't know, said I was describing a antisocial personality disordered person instead of a narcissist. And I'm like, well,
yeah, now, so for the listening audience,
we
said this before, that the antisocial, now that is the new, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders, that is the book that is used to diagnose mental disorders. So it used to be called a sociopath, mm-hmm. is called antisocial personality disorder today. But a lot of people get confused because figuratively, when we say someone's antisocial, we mean, you know, they're kind of like a loner. But that's not what it means in the clinical sense. It is someone that is a sociopath.
Right. But they still have narcissistic behavior.
Yeah. Very, very similar. Yeah, there's no,
I
mean, a woman who...
That they don't, sociopaths really don't have a conscience, or they do, it's a momentary for the moment. And I think with
sociopaths,
they also look at themselves as victims.
The sociopath has very honed interpersonal skill, and they have learned what to say and how to say it in order to be manipulative.
Mm-hmm.
So if they show any type of apologetic behavior, it's all a front.
Mm-hmm.
It really is a front, and that is something that, yeah, a person can get sucked up into it. Immediately, and that's where hope can be a negative emotion. You know, many cases, hope is very positive. But the problem with hope, the flip side, is that it can enable a very destructive behavior to continue because the person is hoping and praying that the other is going to change, you know, stop beating me, stop lying, stop cheating, and that hope can keep them blindly in that relationship. And that is the downside of hope that you usually don't hear anybody talk about.
You know what? That's a really good part that I never really thought about. Right, Deb?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, think about that. You know, I keep hoping and I keep praying, and this is not an anti-prayer message here. I'm just saying that you can still pray and hope, but you still have to take care of business right now. You know, there was just an article this week in the Wall Street Journal that was talking about adults who are in their late 20s, early 30s, that are still being financially supported by their parents, which can, over the decades, rob parents of hundreds of thousands of dollars of retirement money.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you could hope that your 30-year-old kid is going to find a job, but if you enable them to still stay at home as the months go by and they're getting up, you know, watching The Price is Right at, you know, 11 o'clock or whatever time it is in the morning, that hope and praying is counterproductive. You need to hope and pray as you say to them, guess what, you no longer can stay here anymore. So unless you're taking an action to correct something, then the hope just becomes almost like an excuse for enabling the behavior to continue.
Yes, because I stayed in my marriage a long time, and I had that hope for change that never came.
False hope, right. False hope, as Ira said.
Yeah, but we
do this with
policy. And
I think they recognize that in us, Ira, that we're women who always say we're the best, straight wives make the best wives, because we always feel internalized that the blame is ours, rather than accepting that for what it is, that we have to try harder, do more. But we did have one question come in, well, a minute ago, so they asked me if I could ask you this, Ira. Bonnie, can you ask Ira, my husband threatens to kill himself if I leave. I don't think I can live with that. What can I do? He refuses to go to therapy. How would you handle this?
All right, this person... may not like what I'm going to say. Whenever somebody is threatening to kill themselves.
My name is Amy in South Carolina. Amy in South Carolina, by the way.
All right. Amy, whenever somebody, I want you to think now. When someone is threatening to keep a situation the way they want it, or else they're going to kill themselves, I can't think of a more abusive situation emotionally to be in. What I'm concerned, frankly, is not what he's going to do to himself. My first priority is your safety. Do not, under any circumstance, stay with somebody and allow him to manipulate you because he is threatening to kill himself. I would talk to if he has any siblings, if he has parents that are in the picture, let them know what's happening. But at that point, he is no longer your responsibility because all he is doing is drowning in his own anger, hatred, pity, and he's dragging you, and if there's kids involved, he's dragging them into this as well. So I don't want to sound unfeeling here, but if he did take his life, that is his responsibility. He needs help. And he is not going to get the help he needs by bullying you into staying in this relationship that you know is toxic. And I repeat, I am more worried about him harming you than I am about what he's going to do to himself. So there is no
you
easy
mean physically
answer
harming?
To this. I mean specifically
you mean physically.
Exactly. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
If he's capable and he is, if Amy feels that there is a reality that he is capable of taking his life, what's to stop him then from doing like a murder-suicide situation? And that's my concern, is Amy's safety, not this person who greatly needs help and is trying to manipulate her and bully her into staying with him. That is unacceptable. And please don't say you can't live with yourself. Amy, if he would, God forbid, hurt you, you're not going to be alive to live with yourself. So you need to first look at your own safety instead of worrying about this person who may need hospitalization.
And I think also, Amy, just for your information, through the years, and it's been many years that I've been doing this now, you know, over 30 years, that I've had a number of women who have come to me whose husbands all claim the same thing, that if you leave, I'm going to kill myself. And I tell them pretty much, you know, what Ira's saying, that if somebody says that to you and they refuse to go for therapy, you have to let go of that responsibility. And his life is not in your hands. If he can't deal with his life, then either he goes for help, or, as Ira said, call his family for support. You know, tell them that he's having some problems and you can't stay with him and let them deal with it. And I know that sounds easier said than done, especially when somebody's been manipulating you enough to start with to even make those kinds of threats. But you cannot be, I tell all these women, Ira, they can't be emotionally blackmailed into staying in a relationship where they don't belong, right?
No, 100%. And I know, Amy, that, and for people who are listening to this, it sounds, well, you know, it's a lot more complicated than you're making it. I understand that, especially if you're married, you live together, you may have kids together, I understand that this is not an easy decision to make. But you're going and you're staying in a relationship that this will never go away if he feels he has this power over you. So we're not saying that this is easy to do, but unfortunately, you need to get out of this relationship as fast as you can. And I don't know what your support system is, but you know, legal action may certainly have to take place. And then I've heard women who ask this question also say, well, what if he loses his job? I go back to what I just said 5 minutes ago. Amy, my first priority is your safety, not his. He's the one who's manipulating and bullying you. So whatever the repercussions are for him, he's a grown man. He's going to have to deal with that. That is not your responsibility.
And I think it's going to hurt also. Go ahead, Deb.
Oh, I was just going to say there's a law in most states where if a person is a danger to themselves or others, they will take them and put them in a mental facility for a few days to, you know, watch over them.
Yeah, typically it's 72 hours, but what could complicate this is if Amy's heart... is Amy married to this man? Do you know, Bonnie?
Yes. They have children together, too.
Then, you know, let's say he was in law enforcement. And I've heard this before, where a woman will say, but he's in law enforcement. If this happens, it's going to affect his job. And my answer is still the same. It doesn't matter. He should maybe not be in law enforcement and have access to carry a firearm legally if he is not mentally stable. And a mentally stable person does not threaten to kill themselves if you leave. So in this relationship with Amy, does this have anything to do with her husband's sexuality, or is this just, you know, we're talking like a marital?
Oh, yeah, definitely. No, he's gay.
Then, Amy, you need to try and get him in touch with some groups that maybe can give him counseling so he could accept himself for who he is, because I could see he's going through his own battle, but he has to face that battle. You can do it for him.
And it may not
be the nicest person, but if he's that nice a person, see, here's my question for you. If he's that nice a person and a wonderful man and a wonderful father, why has he not only put you in this situation, but why is he expecting you to stay in this marriage that is based on a farce? And that's something that I want to stress, and I'm going to repeat this again. Amy's husband could be the most wonderful father, loving person out there. But there's a big but here, and the big but is he's not heterosexual. He's living a lie with you. You should not have to experience that. So you could still see and acknowledge all the wonderful things in a person, but recognize that by on its own still doesn't justify keeping you in a very, very unhealthy situation. And that is what this man is doing. So if he's so wonderful, why is he doing this to you? And please ask yourself that.
That's a really good point. And also, I think it would be good if maybe you can see a therapist in your area for yourself to help you get stronger, and even maybe at some point have the therapist meet with you and him, you know, if he's willing to go. But, you know, you already said that he's not willing to go. But at least you need to get the strength yourself, because it's very hard to walk out of a situation like that without having some guidance and support. Wouldn't you say so, Ira?
I don't know what Amy's, you know,
though?
Because a lot of times, you know, in situations, and I'm not saying this is Amy's, but, you know, if Amy, her family may not have any inkling to what's going on. Maybe they never wanted her to marry this guy to begin with. So many times that leads to the wife being even more isolated because they feel first embarrassed and they're worried about maybe what their own parents are going to say. So I don't know what Amy's support system is, but without question, she's going to need somebody in her corner that can give her advice that... That's sound, logical advice, not just based on emotions. And Amy, he's not going to be able to change. No matter what he says to you, he is who he is. And what you need to do is worry about, you know, your own health. And I've said this in the past, when people stay in a marriage and they say, I didn't want to, you know, have my kids come from a broken family, the analogy that I give is if you drop a bowl in your kitchen and it's now in a few dozen pieces and you pick up all the pieces and put them in a box, yeah, it's together, but the damn bowl is shattered and broken. So by keeping this relationship going, as your kids get older, they're going to recognize something wasn't right here. And all they're going to have for them is a situation where mom and dad were living a lie. And that is going to be worse than any trauma that may happen as the result of your divorce. You know, what the kids should know, that's something that definitely a therapist that, you know, you should talk about. I don't know the age of your kids. That's something that you need to look at. But without question, this is not something that you should have to accept. And his manipulating you about taking his life, I'm sorry. That is not your, that should not be your responsibility.
Cool. Thank you, Ira. I hope that Amy hears you. And Amy, feel free to write to me anytime, and I can always forward information to Ira. I guess, Ira, what I really want to get back to, something you just mentioned, and get both of your opinions on this, you know, for the last part of our show. Getting back to the whole issue of the Me Too movement and how people feel validated coming out, I think there's a very different, you know, whole point of view when it comes to our women who are married to gay men, that I think one of the reasons it takes so much longer for us to recover from this, and of course the longer you're in it, the longer it seems to take to recover, which is understandable because you've had many more years of beat down than other people who have shorter relationships. But, you know, sometimes it really does take a long time. But I think that the fact that we feel the shame, just like the rape victims or the sexually abused people, who were afraid to talk out because the blame has shifted towards them, like in, you know, 25, 30 years ago, until recent years, where people now listen. Like when we tell people that our husbands are gay, we get the same snickering that, you know, the women who were raped did 25, 30 years ago. What do you mean he's gay? You didn't know he was gay? Why, he wasn't gay when he married you. How did you make him gay? And that is honestly the thoughts, you know, the feedback that you get from people. So my whole thing is that women live with a sense of shame, and their whole lives have been, you know, wiped away in many cases, not all the time. Sometimes there's some really good gay ex-husbands, but for the majority of the women that we work with, you know, their whole lives are just wiped out, and they've been living this life for so many years and so beaten down by it. But people don't look at women who are in this situation. They look at the men as heroes and courageous because they came out. But we're like the side issue that nobody ever talks about because they still feel, well, you must have known something, or how stupid could you be? Everybody else knew he was gay. So how do you change that mentality, Ira, where women don't have to feel embarrassed or ashamed?
Unfortunately,
yes.
Okay, that type of mentality, it's like saying, how do you change racism, you know, you know, or prejudice? You change it by having dignity and walking with dignity and not making apologies. So unfortunately, the general public can be very ignorant and not understand. And that is something that just takes time to address. But in the meantime, a person should not be looking for validation, you know, from the haters that are, or the people that are just plain ignorant out there. So I know that's not the answer you may want to hear, but it's like trying to, how do you get approval from somebody who just doesn't like you? You're never going to get approval from that person. You need to, like, not waste your time on trying to get
approval.
No,
I'm not talking about individuals as a whole, but the cause as a whole. It's so funny. I sent a letter to Variety, you know, the newspaper for actors and actresses, the other day, saying that I'd like to place an ad in there looking for a spokesperson. Because, you know, it seems like every cause has a spokesperson who's a famous spokesperson except ours. And there are so many famous actresses that have married gay men, so they know what it's like. And maybe if somebody who's famous and people listen to would add some insight into this, you know, as far as how people, the suffering that we go through, and that, you know, we are victims of somebody else's, you know, you can say, well, it's society that created this, but yeah, but that society that created men doing it, these men also victimized us, and people don't even acknowledge what we've had to go through. So, you know, sometimes they'll put on funny comedies like The Nanny and her ex-husband, who are they do double dating. That's not reflective of what we go through. And sometimes they'll have on that other one, Frankie and whatever the name was, Lily
Grace
Tomlin
and Frankie
and, you know,
and
James Bond.
What's her name? Fran Drescher in Happily Ever After, where she.
No, that's
married.
Happily Ever After, and then they have the other one with Jane Fonda.
Yeah.
Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin, you know, so. You know, they have these shows on, but they're not necessarily reflective of what we go through, and the message never gets out because people are so ashamed. So that's why with the Me Too movement, the fact that people could stand up, they feel validated. I think our women feel far greater validated if they would come out and say, we're not stuck in his closet anymore. You know, we too.
No, I think you make
what
a very good point there. That certainly would push the issue to the forefront in sort of like an educational way as opposed to a comic way, the way it's presented. Yeah, if you could have somebody that had, you know, national prominence, maybe you could write Oprah and see if Oprah, you know, would do a piece on something like that. But you're right. I've never
seen.
Well,
she's done it before. I've been on Oprah before, you know. But we need a spokesperson. Somebody
who
can be
there. I saw a show with Oprah where she just shamed the woman. Like, you didn't know he was gay. What was wrong
with
you?
Yeah, that could be a problem too. It's that it becomes more like a Jerry Springer type of thing. You know, you're right with that. It's I guess maybe, Bonnie, you know, through some of your writings to see if you can get an article published that, you know, you just, like, points out what you just said about how, you know, the men are looked on, you know, as, like, little heroes, and the women who have been lied to for who knows how many years almost are ridiculed. No, you're right. That's... I think part of the problem of women dealing with these situations is because of what you just said. The public does not give, forget even the word sympathy, is not giving their understanding.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. We're not looking for sympathy. We want understanding and empathy and, you know, acknowledgement that we're not responsible. For instance, you know, we have women who they break up with their marriages and then they had couple friends. And the couple friends are saying, but he was such a nice guy. Okay, it's like one time in my office, I'll never forget, when, you know, my ex-husband was working there with me, and one of the women said, I can't believe that you didn't stay married to him. He is so funny. He is so handsome. He is so, you know, I said, but he's so gay. So she says, well, do you have to look at every little thing? I mean, some people really have that ignorant attitude, every little thing. You know, so... I just don't understand people in general, but I still feel having somebody who's out there that people look up to and who respect, you know, saying that this is what the plight is. I mean, I've certainly tried for many years now to get that word out, but when things come up like Fran Drescher's, you know, Happily Ever After, where she's dating and with, you know, double dating with her gay ex-husband and they're comparing boyfriends or whatever the case is, then this just makes light out of a subject that's so painful for so many women.
No, you're right.
Negates whatever
something,
progress you make.
There needs to be a discussion, whether it's on a legitimate, you know, talk show or somehow in the media that is stressing the points that you're making. And unfortunately, you know, people love, you know, a tremendous amount of drama and something salacious to it. Your situation that you're talking about, you know, it doesn't have that sexy, you know, aura about it that is going to have people glued to the TV. You know, we're always looking for
exactly.
The next train wreck around the corner, and that's just unfortunate. You just look at any of the news stations. You know, everything is shock value.
Well, you know what? It's so interesting that I have so many media requests. I could send you a list of them from the major stations, major shows that I turned down because they're looking for me to find couples who are finding a way to live with this.
Right,
I said,
right.
Why should we promote something that maybe 3% or 5% of the population stays in when 95% of the people don't stay in it?
Right,
because it's
right,
so
yeah,
painful. I said, why don't you do a reverse story and tell what really goes on? But for some reason, that doesn't seem to appeal to them at all. They don't want that aspect. They want those who are staying together and making it work.
Yeah.
And that will misrepresent everything that the reality is. Right, Deb?
Right.
Did you say that?
Yes. I was interviewed some years back for a show that they were going to do on television, but they wanted my ex-husband, too. So that didn't work out.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's what they're all looking for, how you can make it work or how your ex-husband and you are doing together. And, you know, it's just, like I say, we just don't get the validation that we need. And I'm not saying people have to feel sorry for us, but they have to understand us. I think, Ira, you really pointed that out best of all. We're not looking for sympathy. We're looking for understanding.
Yeah, and I
it's
guess
very
it's
hurtful
a never-ending
when people
process.
Accuse us again of we must be at fault for this happening, right?
Yeah. No, you're right. You're right. Yeah.
So any last thoughts for the night, Ira, because we're going to be wrapping up in about 2 minutes.
I just want to go back and say that a hopefully remember, you know, whoever is going through a tragedy of any kind, don't look at the fault piece of it. Just look at yourself with respect and integrity about being a person who is trying to make a stand for yourself and your family. Don't get caught up in the past. Think about what you can do to make your life better in the future.
Okay. Not easy, but it can be done because many of us do it. And Deborah, you have some wonderful books out that people can find on Amazon. And you just go to Deborah Sutton. And also Deborah has a whole blog situation going. If you need more information, write to me and I'll forward it over to Deborah. Deborah, thank you so much for always being there for all these women who desperately need you and your good advice and your good thoughts and your dedication to this whole cause and for not giving up when many times we feel like it, right? Well, not so much anymore because now we don't have people attacking us like they used to since we know who they are, right?
Right.
Exactly. So, anyway, Ira, I really hope that you'll honor us again in a few months.
Without
in September
question.
When
this
we
is
start
like the
on.
Fastest hour of the week for me when I do this. I mean, I cannot believe an hour just went by.
I know. It went by fast.
I know. So, thank you both. And next week we'll be having our last show for, you know, the summer season, and we'll be starting again in September. And maybe, Ira, you'll be our first guest, if you don't mind, because you just give so much insight.
My pleasure.
We'd love to start our season off with you. All right, so to all our listeners, I'm sending my love and good night. Ira, you know I love you. And Deb, I love you. And to all of our listeners, have a better week. Right, if you need help or support, we're here for you. So good night, everybody.
Okay, good night.
Good night.
Bye-bye.